Hari Kondabolu is a whip-smart, politically-minded stand-up comedian and public radio darling. He's performing in Atlanta at Center Stage in Midtown on Friday, February 17th. Hari, welcome to City Lights.
Thank you, Lois. Public radio darling is one of the greatest phrases I've ever heard. So thank you for that.
And you don't even have to pledge to get that title. For you, we're just going to say you are a public radio darling.
Thank you.
So your second comedy album, Mainstream American Comic, reached number one last year. There's a certain irony in the title. Would you elaborate?
Absolutely. Well, it's definitely more ironic now more than ever. The album is about the idea that I'm not seen as a mainstream person. I'm not considered part of the mainstream as a person of color. Also, as somebody with the politics that I have, very progressive minded, and yet my comedy certainly isn't seen as that as well. And I believe it should be, because my story, the son of immigrants from India, that's part of the American story. You know, that's a key part of the American story, the idea of immigration. And also, as a person of color, that is a key part and a key point of view in the American story. And my humor that talks about those experiences as well as, social justice, I feel like that is something, even if people don't like the phrase social justice, when you're talking about equality and fairness, that's a universal principle as well.
Yeah.
So why can't I be seen as mainstream just because I talk about the things I talk about and I look the way I look and my background is what it is?
Do you think there are people who actually would object to the word social justice?
Yes, I think there's a lot of people that do not like that phrase. I mean, we speak in these little phrases, right? And they're shorthand for these bigger ideas. And when I hear social justice, I know what I think of. I think of the actual work. I think about fair housing and fighting racism and gender discrimination and homophobia and transphobia. I have these images that come to mind. When other people see social justice, they think people who want more taxes and who supports an underclass that they see as shady and scary. And, you know, all sorts of weird things come into mind because, you know, a phrase that's so small like that can be changed depending on who's using it.
Uh-huh.
But if you talk about the actual issues, the things people actually care about, and you avoid certain phrases like activists and social justice, it's I'm funny. I'm good on stage. I can connect to people. It doesn't matter what those phrases are. I find them irrelevant to me. It's, are you listening to the stuff? Can you understand what I'm saying? Do you find it funny? It's finding that common ground that is going to push us forward.
Well, the serious concerns of a comedian's perspective are fascinating. In your case, I think revelatory here. And you actually pursued a master's degree in human rights at the London School of Economics. Would you talk about how your comedy intersects with human rights? You began to touch upon it a moment ago.
Absolutely. So my background was as an immigrant rights organizer. I lived in Seattle for a couple of years, and I did comedy at night. It was a hobby. It was something I loved to do and I planned to do for the rest of my life, and it didn't really matter if it was in a professional capacity or not. Like, I knew that was something I loved. And plus, I didn't see it as a realistic option, really. Just at the time, there weren't that many South Asians doing it. So I kept it as a hobby, and I wanted justice, you know, especially really coming of age post 9/11, seeing where the country was in the middle of two wars and with hate crimes being committed around the country and people being detained and deported. I mean, honestly, what we're experiencing right now is triggering. It's very familiar to me. So after that point, I get this job in Seattle working as an immigrant rights organizer, and I decide I want a master's degree in human rights because I felt like a human rights framework was really important. We don't really talk about human rights in a very clear way here. You know, we talk about our rights. Gun rights are considered part of our fundamental rights. But when we talk about human rights, what does that mean? What kind of coalitions can we build internationally? And I thought that would be useful on my part to get that education. And while I was, applying to school, I was discovered by the HBO Comedy Festival, which is now defunct. But they're a festival that discovered new talent. And I sent them some of my comedy. And the next thing I know, I have a manager and I'm at this festival and I'm on Jimmy Kimmel Live. And the next day after Jimmy Kimmel Live, I went right back to work from the airport and pretended nothing happened. Like, it was a weird place to be. And so those two things, comedy and the idea of justice and activism, I don't see them as separate things that are intertwining, because I'm both of those things.
Yeah.
Like, I've been a comedian longer than I've, maybe was politically minded. I've been doing comedy since I was 16 or 17 years old. I've been collecting my thoughts for most of my life. And I think that being someone who wanted to create positive change in the world, that came later. But they both sync up for me. Like, when I'm on stage, I'm not making political jokes. I'm sharing my observations on the world. To me, it's observational comedy. It's the first thing I see. There's no special lens that I apply. So I think, to me, it's one and the same.
And is it your hope that the takeaway from your comedy might lead to activism?
No, I think I want people to laugh. That's really as simple as that. I like hearing that positive things come out of it. Like, I know that my first album, especially Waiting for 2042, is on a bunch of high school and college curriculums and a few grad school curriculums, which I certainly did not expect. Like, I don't think anybody expects that when they release a comedy album, but it certainly makes me feel proud. I'm proud that that's the byproduct. Seeing things I wrote as jokes or setups to jokes, being on protest signs. I mean, it was amazing. People sending me pictures of things I've said on protest signs during the Women's March and during the No Bad, No Wall March, or during the Black Lives Matters marches and rallies. Like, these are beautiful things, but that is not my intention. My intention is to be the best stand-up comedian I can be on the terms that I want to, on my terms. You know, I want to be honest with my point of view, like all the greats did. And people can read phonies. I don't want to be that. I want to stretch out the form and see all the new ways one can hide a punchline. Like, I focus on what's in front of me. That's all you can focus on. Just focus on the task in front of you.
But you're enlightening people along the way, that you're making them laugh.
Sure. I mean, I think there are people who, especially younger people, I will say, more than anything, like when I do colleges, I love the fact there are people who are being exposed to critical thought for the first time. But I don't go in with the intention. I'm aware of the possibility of it. But if you go in with that intention, you're not writing to be funny. You're writing to educate. And when you write to educate, there's a real risk there of losing your focus, right? Like, there's lots of art that I've heard that is socially aware and thoughtful and to me righteous, but I don't like the art. To me, it's not entertaining or interesting, because the focus has been so much on the message and not on how do we, you can play to your circles and people would like that, but you really want to, reach as many people as possible. And to reach as many people as possible, like, you have to be great at the art form and connect to people. And so I want to be the best stand-up comic I can be. And, from there we can, if it affects people, fantastic. But I can't focus on that when I'm up there.
It seems that so many great comics, their work is informed by being an outsider or being on the margins. Is that what you feel is at the essence of your comedy?
Absolutely, 100%. That is such a fundamental part of how I do things. And I think I felt it the most doing shows in India. I did shows in India a few years ago, and I remember just how strange it was to be seen as an American on stage. Because normally I'm up there talking about being a marginalized person, being in a marginalized community in America, not being seen as American. But as far as the people in the audience in the various Indian cities I performed at were concerned, I was American. Like, that distinction doesn't really play. I was talking the way, like, I speak the way I speak. I talk quickly. I'm interested in very American-centric issues. Like, I'm an American. And it really threw me off, because I I'm not used to that here. Here it's pretty straight. When I go on stage, I know I'm the outsider. I mean, that's not that hard. But in other countries, it's amazing to feel American finally.
Well, did any of your audiences in India hear your thoughts on Christopher Columbus?
No, I should have done that bit now that I think about it, because I had written it by then. But I
Because I would think they'd find that brilliant.
Columbus is why I have to tell people that I'm Indian from India. Come on. For real? Of course I am. That's where Indians originally come from. India, the factory that makes them. How do you assume a place without silk, spices, or elephants is India? You'd have to be an idiot or an egomaniac. And judging by his hat, he was clearly both. Come on.
I remember I had an uncle once who, because he'd heard my stand-up, or maybe he saw something I did on TV about Columbus Day, and he said, "Why are you so worried and concerned about those issues? You know, that's, you know, those aren't Indian issues. Why are you concerned about those issues? And we're not even that kind of Indian." And I said, like, you know that Columbus was looking for us. So it was he robbed someone's home, but it was our neighbor's home, and he meant it to be our home. So, you know, we're still in a bad neighborhood. Like, we're still at risk here. Don't think just because your neighbor got robbed that you're safe.
Yeah, with the English picked up where he left off.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, it certainly worked out for some people, yes.
Now that we're in the era of Trump, has your style changed in the last few months?
It's actually kind of strange. Not really. And that's because I think the things I've talked about for the bulk of my career have been these evergreen issues, these things, unfortunately, that will not go away anytime soon, like racism and sexism and or the old classics like colonialism and imperialism. Like, these are things that unfortunately have been there for quite some time and will be there even if they mutate and they look differently. They will still be there for quite some time. So when you have a president who is up there saying things that are racist or Islamophobic or sexist, if anything, it helps me in that, you know, people don't need to draw from their memories to relate to what I'm talking about. I just have to say, remember when the president said this? And then I just do the bit that I plan to do anyway. Because unfortunately, he makes the stuff that I've always talked about even more relevant.
You enjoy wordplay, and you have some hilarious bits on language and cliches like playing devil's advocate and boys will be boys. What's your take on alternative facts?
Oh, my God. I mean, English is an amazing language in that you can really play with it to try to explain yourself. I mean, I don't know if we needed another synonym for lie. I felt like we had that covered, but this is a new one. It's scary when up is down and down is up, and we go along with it, and it's... I mean, honestly, the thing I read about recently was the Kellyanne Conway talking about the massacre that happened at Bowling Green, and there was no massacre at Bowling Green. Like, it's this weird hyperbole mixed with lies. And the thing is, it's weird to criticize the media and say that they're lying when you are not even subtle about your lies as an administration. I mean, for comedy, this is good. It's pointing out hypocrisy. I mean, they make it very simple, but for the betterment of society, this is very bad.
Okay. Well, Hari, you're working on a documentary about the Simpsons character Apu. What are you exploring in that documentary?
I mean, what I'm exploring with the Apu documentary is a lot of the issues I've explored throughout my career, the idea of who gets to be American and, you know, what does that look like? You know, it was hard to be seen as an American when I was growing up because for the first two decades of my life, pretty much, the only character that existed that represented us was this cartoon character, Apu on The Simpsons, who's voiced by Hank Azaria, who is a brilliant voice actor, but he's white, and it's a caricature, you know. And he based his impression on the Peter Sellers impression in The Party. I mean, that's very upsetting. But that was the only thing we had, and you know, it wasn't like a throwaway show or some random movie. It's The Simpsons. Like, I love The Simpsons. I'm a gigantic Simpsons fan, and it's the show that taught me it was okay to be smart and funny. That it doesn't mean that you're unfunny because you have to explain something a bit or that not everyone gets it. I felt special when I got a joke not everyone got. It's such beautiful writing. And you know, so it was strange to see something I love still hurt me. And that's really what a big part of this documentary is. Like, in addition to the legacy of minstrelsy, the fact that Apu isn't an isolated figure, it comes from a larger tradition in this country, unfortunately. But also, you know, what does it feel like to not feel American? How is that kind of, you know, thrust upon us? You know, how do we get othered? And how you can love something and still criticize it? You know, and that, to me, that's what being an American is. You can love the place you're at and still criticize it. So that's really what this film's about.
It's supposed to be one of our fundamental rights.
Yeah, it's a privilege. It is a privilege. And as a comedian, I feel privileged that I get to do that professionally.
Did you ever hear or have you heard from Matt Groening, from anyone at The Simpsons, since you have brought Apu into your comedy?
We haven't heard from Matt Groening, and of course that was somebody we very desperately wanted to get to because, you know, he's God in this particular story, right? But Hank Azaria, certainly I know that he knows who I am, and that he's seen my piece, and he's done, you know, interviews where he's talked about, you know, seeing my, I did a piece on Totally Biased, a TV show that my friend W. Kamau Bell used to host. And the piece was about, you know, the Indian American community. I specifically focus on Apu.
Apu, a cartoon character voiced by Hank Azaria, a white guy. A white guy doing an impression of a white guy making fun of my father.
And Hank Azaria saw that, and it actually impacted him, and he talks about it in an interview, just how it was the first time it really hit him that, like, this is the only character that a community had, and how would I feel if it was a Jewish character and we only had this one caricature? And so I know that he's aware of my work, and which is a hell of a thing to idolize a show, to be critical of that show, and for the people on the show to actually think about what I'm saying. It reached them.
Did he apologize?
No. I mean, kind of. I mean, I think he acknowledged it. And he, what is an apology if you still do it?
Yeah.
I mean, the show's still going and he still speaks publicly using the voice, which, by the way, is very strange to watch when you see Hank Azaria do an Indian accent without the cartoon being present. It feels really different.
Okay.
It felt like kind of startling. Yeah.
How did your parents react?
To The Simpsons?
To Apu, yeah.
I mean, talking to them, I mean, their view is very, very different. My mom, you know, talks about, like, we were trying to fight to survive in this country and to make sure you and your brother got what you both needed. Like, the idea that we were mocked in this way, like, we already knew it was tough. We already were sure that there were people that maybe didn't view us as equal or mocked us, but that wasn't the focus. We had two kids. We had you to focus on. And there, this idea that we're immigrants, we're not from here, we're learning the place. I think for my mom, she was more frustrated because to her, we were entitled to more. We were born here. There's no questioning. There shouldn't be a questioning of this. Should never be a questioning of that, to be perfectly honest. But to her, it's like, as natural born citizens of this country, why are you, you know, teasing my kids? And I think for her, that's what hit them. But in their own lives, this is a country that they have grown to love, right? And but it wasn't like they'd been in this country a decade, if that much, when that show came out. Like, there was another focus.
And your mother gave up a career as a physician.
Yeah.
When she came here, you know, to be mocked. Not that there's any shame in having a convenience store, sure. But it brings to mind Amos and Andy. And, you know, thinking about The Simpsons on the same wavelength as Amos and Andy, that's surreal, too.
But, oh, my God, it hurts.
Yeah.
It hurts, honestly, because, that was the hurt that I felt going to school because, you know, if it was an Apu episode of The Simpsons, and we were all talking about it on Monday, what happened on The Simpsons the night before. We had to. I mean, that's what we did. And it was frustrating because there were so many funny lines and the stories were so ridiculous. And yet there was going to be something Apu said that I knew I had to deal with.
Mm. As if just showing up at school wasn't enough.
Right. Well, I mean, I'm lucky that I grew up in Queens, at least. You know, it's the most diverse place in the world. So I can only imagine what it was like when you were the only brown person in class. And I had the privilege of, you know, having others.
So. Your mother, you credit with informing your humor or getting your sense of humor from her. It sounds like that was quite a coping mechanism for her as well.
Yeah, absolutely. People ask me, like, can we still laugh when things are this difficult? Are we, you know, are we allowed to tell jokes? And I'm like, how do people think jokes and humor work? I mean, it's a defense mechanism. It saves you. It's resistance. And my mom has always done that. Like, I don't think it's an easy thing to work to be a doctor, a woman doctor in southern India in the 70s, in a conservative climate. That is an achievement. There were all these young women that looked up to my mother, and she gave all that up and came to this country. That is tragic. I mean, there's two ways to go. You either fold or you find a way to deal with it, and humor was always part of that.
And then on the 4th of July, I said, "Happy Independence Day, Mom." And she said, "Thanks, son, but I lost my independence 35 years ago." So that plus anxiety equals comedian. There you go.
I think about the fact that she, you know, she can joke about the darkest things and she can find some light in it. And, you know, I think that is a difficult thing to do. And the fact that she does it is amazing.
Well, without being a physician, you are clearly carrying on the family talent.
Oh, Lois, thank you.
And
thank
hurry, you for saying that. If I can just close by refuting something you said, you are anything but a killjoy who does comedy. Come on. I hope you get airport reparations. I would vote in favor of it.
Thank you, Lois.
Thank you.
That is wonderful. Thank you.
It's been a joy.